One of the most famous stories surrounding the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash is the story of Kamsa Ubar Kamsa. The story found in the Gemara in Gittin tells the story of a man who accidentally invites his enemy to his party and subsequently throws him out in a big scene. And it's often used to highlight how sinat chinam, how baseless hatred of our fellow Jews led to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. While this message is certainly very important, I'm going to focus on a different lesson learned from this story today. We're going to study this story as the first in a series of narratives that talk about the events leading up to the destruction of Yerushalayim. We'll explore a common message that these stories convey about the days and years before the Churban. Much of what I'm going to say today is based on an article by Dr. Jeffrey Rubinstein and his book, we have called Talmudic Narratives, where he has an article on these sections of the Gemara. I was introduced to this book by a class I took at Yale University. Living in Toronto, my husband and I served as a Jewish Learning Initiative on campus educators, JLIC, at Yale University. One of the perks of the job was we can audit classes in the university when we had time. So I took a class by Dr. Yishai Kiel, a visiting professor from Israel, called Talmudic Narratives in Context. And what I'm talking about today is a lot influenced by the class I took with him. So we're going to begin the story of Kamsa or Bar Kamsa in Gittin 55b, Nun Hei Bet. That's in source number one. So the story is first introduced by a statement of Rav Yochanan. Amar Rav Yochanan, my dechtiv, ashrei adam mefached tamid, makshali bo yupol bara'ah. Where do we see this statement come true in Mishle, where it says, happy is the person who is scared always? In context, it's talking about scared of what their actions might lead to, so more like cautious. So happy is the person who's cautious always, but the person who hardens his heart will fall into misfortune. Where do we see this happening? He says there's three cases of this happening. Akamsa bar kamsa charuv shalayim. Because of Kamsa or Bar Kamsa, Yerushalayim was destroyed. Artanagolava, Tarnagoltal, Charuv, Tor Malka, because of this rooster, the Tor Malka was destroyed. And the last case was destruction of Beit Har. So it goes into, first of all, Rubinstein points out that this literary style of like giving you the punchline before the story, saying these three things are happening, it tells you that the stories are not focusing on the events of what is going to happen in a suspense way, but rather about why it happened and how it came to be. So the Gemara then goes into the story of Kamsa or Bar Kamsa. So we'll continue. A Kamsa or Bar Kamsa chal Yerushalayim. Jerusalem was destroyed because of Kamsa or Bar Kamsa. First of all, the word Kamsa, anyone know what the word Kamsa means? Means a locust. Comes from the words kind of like Mr. Locust and Locust Jr. This idea of what's a locust? A locust is someone who, an insect that swarms in and leaves destruction in its path, comes in quickly and destroys. So giving this foreshadowing that because of these people, Kamsa or Bar Kamsa, destruction, doom is coming. So the story goes, Dehahu Gavra, Derachme Kamsa, or Baldavave Bar Kamsa. There was a man whose friend was Kamsa and whose enemy was Bar Kamsa. Avatsu, that's how he made a party. Amar Leshame, Zil Ati Le Kamsa. He told his servants, go invite Kamsa to join my party. Azal Ati Le Bar Kamsa. Accidentally, the servant brings his enemy Bar Kamsa. They're at the party. So this host sees Bar Kamsa, his enemy, sitting there. Since this man, Bar Kamsa, is the enemy of this man, the host, my baitacha, what do you want here? Kumpok, get out of here. Amar lai, he's very embarrassed. To be kicked out of a party is embarrassing. Ho'yuva aiti shavkin, once I'm already here, just let me stay. V'yahavna lei lach demei ma'ad achilna v'shatina, and I'll pay you for whatever I eat and drink. Amar lai lo, the host says no, get out of here. Amar lai yahavni lei demei pagadu su'datech, I will even pay you half of this whole party. Amar lai lo, he says no, get out of here. I will pay for your whole entire party. Just let me stay. It's very embarrassing to be kicked out of here. Lo, he says no. He grabbed him by the hands, picked him up, and threw him out of the party. So Bar Kamsa is so ashamed of how he was made to feel at this party that he devises a plan of revenge. But his revenge is not directed at the host, the person who threw him out, but it's directed at the rabbis. See, Amar, Ho'il, V'yahatve, Rabbanan, V'lo Malchube. The rabbis were sitting there and didn't try to stop him. Shmamina kanichaluhu. That implies to me that they agreed with him, that I should leave. Izel Yechuba Kurtzami Malka. I'm going to go and tell on them to the Roman kingdom and get back at them. Now, it seems strange to us that his revenge is addressed to the rabbis. We haven't even heard of the rabbis being at this party at all to begin with, right? We don't even hear about it in the story that they were there. And Rubenstein says that's exactly the point. The rabbis could have well have not been there because they didn't do anything. They just sat and enjoyed themselves and didn't act. When threatened to kick out, when the host had told, threatening to kick out Bar Kamsa, the rabbis could have done a number of things. They could have convinced him to stay, said, what's the big deal? He's already here, please let him stay, it's embarrassing. Or they could have left the party in protest. So if this host is kicking out somebody, it's, you know, we're all gonna leave. We don't wanna be part of this party anymore. But they did neither. They sat there, quietly, passively. And for this, Bar Kamsa seeks his revenge. So what does Bar Kamsa do? I'll continue this story in the Gemara or in English. He went and said to the emperor, the Jews are rebelling against you. He said, how can I tell? I have no idea the Jews are rebelling against me. He said to them, send them an offering of korban and see whether they'll offer it or not. So the Caesar, the emperor, sent them a fine calf. While on the way, he made a blemish on the upper lip, or some say on the eye, in a place where the Jews count a blemish, but the Romans do not. So the rabbis are now faced with a quandary. Do they offer this korban or not? Right? So let's see. The rabbis were inclined to offer it in order not to offend the government. Okay, so they said on the one hand, it might make sense to bring this korban, even though according to halacha, the Torah, we're not supposed to bring a korban with a blemish on the mizbeach. There's also a value of shalom ha-malchut, shalom medina, and having peace with the government. And we know that if we don't offer this korban, they might retaliate against us. So you can see that, you know, there's room to make a solid argument for why it should be offered. But Rav Zecharia ben Avkulu says to them, people will say that blemished animals are offered on the Mizbayach. You can't bring this korban. What will people say? They're going to conclude from this bringing the korban that you're allowed to bring animals that don't have, that have a blemish on them. So then they had another option. They proposed to kill Bar Kamsa, so he should not go and inform against them. And they said, maybe, you know, obviously we don't kill generally, but if this person is going to report back to the Romans, and because of that, the Romans are going to kill all of us, we can justify perhaps killing Bar Kamsa so he won't go and tell the Romans. But again, Rav Zecharia ben Avkulu says to them, is one who makes a blemish on consecrated animals to be put to death? People might conclude from you killing him that you killed him because he was going to offer an animal that had a mum on it, a blemish on it. So again, we can't do that either. Again, it's a tough decision. Which do they choose? Neither. Again, they're passive. They don't bring the korban, and they leave Bar Kamsa alone. Just like at the party, the rabbis refrain from acting. They're dissuaded from choosing one of these options by Rav Zachariah ben Avkulus. So interestingly, again, his concerns are not the ones that would have thought of, right? That, you know, dilemma, can making peace override bringing the korban that had the blemish? You know, how is murder is wrong? How can we justify it here? It's all about what are people going to say? What are they going to conclude from it? You know, obviously, I think people would have concluded this is an extenuating circumstance. They're not going to make general principles based on this one case, but that's what he's concerned about. Rav Zachariah is being overly cautious, and that's why the story concludes, Amar Rav Yochanan, Anvanutanuto, Sha Rabbi Zachariah ben Avkulus. This Anvanut, oh, it's translated as meekness, this overly cautiousness, Hechridu et Beitenu, destroyed our home, Fesurfa Hechalenu, burnt down our sanctuary, Vihiglatenu Merseinu, made us exiled from our land. Then the online version I got it from translates it as scrupulousness. So his overly scrupulousness or his meekness is what led to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. So what does this word actually mean? In other contexts, anvitanut has a very positive connotation. Similar to the word anava, humility, it means lots of good things. So I brought two examples of positive ways that it's used. So in source number two, the Gemara in Megillah says, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Kol makom sh'atah motzig v'rotzo shel Kadosh Baruch Hu, in any place that you find God's power, atah motzei anvatanuto. You also find, in this context, his gentleness. God is the God of gods, Lord of lords of lords. The very next pasuk says, he's the one who does justice for the orphan and the widow. So we see God's, again, anvanut here is referred to gentleness, kindness. In source number three, we have the discussion in the Gemara Mishabbat is talking about Shammai's and Hillel's approaches to conversion, to when converts come to them and ask to convert, what are their approaches? That's when, you know, it says, Hillel says, love your neighbor like yourself, the rest is commentary. So he says, the Gemara says, Amar, Kaptanato Shel Shammai, Bikshah L'Tardenu, the impatience of Shammai sought to drive us from this world, Tardenu min ha'olam, v'anvanutano shel Hillel, kervanu tachat kanfei ha'shechina. This gentleness of Hillel in seeking us in brought us under the wings of Shechina. So these are just two cases where this trait is anvanut, being humble, gentle, is very positive. Rubinstein says that he can't think of any other place in rabbinic literature where anvanut means something negative or bad. So here he's saying it means meekness, even like wimpiness, not being able to stand up for himself. So generally, it's beneficial for rabbis to have this trait, to be anvanut, to be humble, patient, gentle. We don't want a leader who's arrogant and rash. But in this situation, when faced with this difficult decision, this over-cautiousness of Rav Zachariah paralyzed the rabbis from acting. And their passivity then helps bring about the destruction. That's what Yochanan means by his opening statement. He says, you know, happy is the person who's cautious always. God-fearing people need to be cautious, but misfortune falls the one who hardens his heart and refuses to act. We hear about Rav Zacharia ben Alfkalus in another context as well. That's in the Tosefta in source 4. It's talking about the rules of Shabbat and Muktzah, things that you can't touch things on Shabbat that have no use on Shabbat. So the Tosefta is discussing what to do with bones and shells left over from eating on Shabbat, because presumably they are Muktzah, they have no use anymore on Shabbat. Beit Hillel Omer Megbi'in Me'al HaShulchan Atzmot V'Klipin. Beit Hillel says you're allowed to still move them from the table. You can remove the bones and shells from the table. Beit Shammai Emri Masalek Et HaTavla Kula V'Narah. He says you have to turn over the whole table. You can't touch the bones and shells directly. Zechariah ben Avkulos Lo Hayanoheg Lo K'divrei Beit Shammai V'Lo K'divrei Beit Hillel. This Zechariah chooses neither one. Right? He can't decide between Beit Hillel and Beit Shammai. So instead, notzel mashlich lachar himitza, right after eating the food, he throws it behind the couch. So he doesn't have to worry about touching it afterwards from the table. Amar Rav Yossi, anvenutano shal Rav Zacharia ben Avkulus, srafa etachechal. Right, his overly cautiousness, his meekness in making a decision is what brought about destroying the temple. So again, Rav Zacharia here is being described as being overly weak. He can't decide to the point where it ends up doing something ridiculous, eating, throwing his food up behind him. His lack of decisiveness makes him act foolishly at the Shabbat table and has dire consequences for the Jerusalem being destroyed in our story. So back to our story in Gitzin. So why didn't the rabbis take action with the korban? You know, perhaps they're waiting for a miracle. They're waiting for God to save them, sitting back. And unfortunately, or perhaps ironically, they were afraid to act because of how others would read their actions. In the end, the Romans read their actions as saying that they're rebelling when they weren't even intending it. So unlike the rabbis, the next story in the Gemara features a character who does take action under difficult circumstances. So this is the Gemara, this is under B, it's the continuation of the previous Gemara in Gitzin. I'm going to read in English for time. The emperor sent against them Nero, the Caesar, right? After this whole episode with the Korban, so the emperor sends them Nero to destroy Jerusalem. So as he was coming, he shot an arrow towards the east, it fell in Jerusalem. He then shot one towards the west, and again, it fell in Jerusalem. He shot towards all four points of the compass, and each time it fell in Jerusalem. What's he doing here? Again, he was sent on a mission to destroy Jerusalem. But first, he asks for a sign to make sure this is the right thing to do. He's cautious. He says, I want to make sure I'm doing the right thing. The sign points to Jerusalem, saying, yes, you are supposed to be destroying Yerushalayim. But he's still not convinced. He wants a second sign. He finds a certain boy. He says to him, repeat to me the last verse of scripture that you have learned. He says, he quotes him the verse, I will lay my vengeance upon Edom by the hand of my people Israel. The verse that he asks the schoolboy to repeat from him, says how God is going to take revenge for those who destroyed the Beit HaMikdash on the people who destroyed it. Edom is Rome. So he says, "What you know? If I destroy it, on the one hand, he's told to destroy the Yerushalayim. If he doesn't destroy it, he has the emperor who's going to kill him. On the other hand, if he does destroy it, God is then going to take revenge against himself." Just like the rabbis, he's caught in the dilemma of what to do. But unlike the rabbis, he finds a third option. He chooses neither one, but he acts. What does he do? He says, first of all, his dilemma, the Holy One, blessed be he, desires to lay waste his house and lay me to blame. That was the dilemma. So what did he do? He ran away, he became a proselyte, he converts. Rabbi Meir was descended from him. Okay, so he converts to Judaism. So ironically, this decision of this non-Jew ultimately leads to Rabbi Meir in the continuity of Torah, where the rabbi's decision or non-decision leads to the destruction and the seizing of Torah. The next narrative also offers a contrast between those who take action and those who are passive. So the story continues in paragraph C. He then sent against them Vespasian the Caesar, who came and besieged Jerusalem for 3 years. So this is the beginning of the destruction. Jerusalem was put in the siege, but they were in there, the city, three men of great wealth, Nachdimon, Ben-Gurion, Ben-Kabbal-Sabua, and Ben-Sisit HaKaset. And these men were in a position to keep the city for 21 years. They had enough food that the siege wouldn't bring the destruction. They had enough food, storehouses, they could last for 21 more years. But the Bir Yonai were then in the city. These are like translated as thugs, these people who wanted to fight the Romans. They were not happy with sitting in peace in their, you know, their own Jerusalem for 21 years. They wanted to fight. The rabbi said to them, "Let's go and make peace with them, with the Romans." But they would not let them. The Bir Yonai would not let the rabbis make peace. So first of all, it's interesting to see that the rabbis are somehow in a power struggle with the Bir Yonai. The rabbis are leaders, are not able to overcome the Bir Yonai. Perhaps their passivity, which was displayed in the story of Bar Kamsa and Kamsa, has led people to turn to other leaders who are more active and who are making decisions. So they don't want to make peace, but instead, but on the contrary, they want to go and fight. They want to make war with the Romans. But the rabbi said, "You will not succeed." Right? So they didn't say that. They can think of all sorts of reasons why not to fight, but their answer was, you're not going to be good at it anyway. You're going to lose." The statement of "it won't help anyway" is the most passive statement somebody can make. You know, the rabbis are saying, "We don't have a good answer for you. Just it's not going to work. It's not going to help." They're being passive here again. So the Bir Yonai take matters into their own hands. The last line, they then rose up and burnt the stores of wheat and barley so that famine ensued, right? So you might not agree with their tactic. They went ahead and burned all the food that these three rich men had in the city in order to make the people hunger so they'll fight. And it might, again, you might not agree with that. It's kind of extreme, but you can somehow commend them for at least taking action in doing something to fight against the Romans, which they believed in. Interestingly, the words for rabbis, the Rabbanan and Bir Yonai, have the same letters in them, just rearranged. In some ways, they're the foils of the rabbis. This is what Rubinstein's words, when the rabbis fail to act as rabbis, as leaders, the anti-rabbis take over, right? The people who are, you know, say we can take power because we are going to make decisions for you. The story of the Bir Yonai is followed by an anecdote of a wealthy woman named Marta, who's herself going to look for food during the siege. And this is section D. Marta, the daughter of Boethius, was one of the richest women in Jerusalem. She sent her servant out saying, "Go and bring me some fine flour." By the time he went out, it was sold out. He came and told her, "There's no fine flour, but there is white flour." She then said to him, "Go and bring me some of the white flour." By the time he went, he found the white flour sold out. He came and told her, "There's no white flour, but there is dark flour." She said to him, "Go and bring me some of that." By the time he went, it was sold out. He returned and said to her, "There's no dark flour, but there's barley flour." She said, "Go and bring me some of that." By the time he went, it was sold out. So she had taken off her shoes, but she said, "I will go out and see if I can find anything to eat." Some dung stuck to her foot and she died. Some report that she ate a fig left by Rab Sadok, who became sick and died. So literally, this story has several parallels to our opening story of Kamsa or Bar Kamsa. Right? They both have this master asking their servant to bring them something. Bring me kamsa, bring me flour. The servant does not bring what the master asked for. He does not bring kamsa, he brings bar kamsa, and the servant cannot bring the flour that she requests. They both involve food and wealth and food. Right? Kamsa is offering to pay for all the food, but the master refuses and kicks him out. Whereas Marta has all the money in the world, but just can't find any food to eat. Kamsa is kicked out of the party to the street, whereas Marta leaves her wealthy home voluntarily to go look for food on the street. So continuing this theme of passivity when it comes to making difficult decisions, this servant is just incapable of making a decision that seems so obvious to any of us, right? So while generally speaking, it's wise for a servant to listen to his master and to not sway off from what the master told him, the servant should have realized that this situation is different. There's an extenuating circumstances here, and he should make a decision, have the confidence to make a decision on his own, to buy whatever flour was available in the marketplace, right? This servant is displaying this anvitanut, this meekness, this wimpiness of not being able to decide anything for himself. Right, too scared to buy the wrong thing, he buys nothing at all. Which tells us that sometimes you have to risk making a wrong decision. Doing that is better than making no decision at all, just being passive. So after this story, we have two stories involving rabbis who act contrary to the other rabbis of the story, and they do something to change their situation. So the first is Rav Tzadok, who, again, in the Marta story, said he was eating these figs. Why was he eating these figs? So it says, Rav Tzadok observed fasts for 40 years in order that Jerusalem might not be destroyed. He became so thin that when he ate anything, the food could be seen as it passed through his throat. When he wanted to restore himself, they used to bring him a fig, and he used to suck the juice and throw the rest away. When Marta was about to die, she brought out all her gold and silver, threw it in the street, saying, What is the good of this to me? Thus giving effect to the verse, they shall cast silver in the streets. This continues the story of Marta. But unlike the other rabbis who kind of are feasting at the party that this host is throwing, kind of unaware, oblivious to the fact that the Chorban is about to happen, Rav Tzadok has been fasting for 40 years. Obviously, he's doing something about it. We see it didn't help. The Chorban still came, but at least he was trying to do something to change the situation. The final story of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai involves another story, a rabbi, again, who breaks this trend of inaction and takes action. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai reaches out to the head of the Bir Yonai, the head of these thangs, his nephew, Abba Sikra, to do something to help him get out of the siege. This is in paragraph F. Abba Sikra, the head of the Bir Yonai in Jerusalem, was the son of the sister of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So he sent to him saying, come and visit me privately. Right? I want to talk to you about a plan. When he came to him, he said, how long are you going to carry on this way and kill all the people with starvation? What are you going to do? Everyone's dying here. Abba Sikra replied, what can I do? If I say a word to them, they'll kill me. So here again, you see this Biryon, this leader. Again, he's the leader of the Biryonai, who before could overpower the rabbis in deciding what to do, and now he's powerless. Right? The leaders can no longer be leaders anymore. The leader is no longer in control. So he says to him, devise some plan for me to escape. Perhaps I shall be able to save a little. Because I can't save all of Yerushalayim. The rabbis tried. They tried to make peace. They thought about war. Neither one could save Jerusalem. It didn't work. But rather than give up, Rabbi Yochanan is saying, let me do something, I can save something. At least I can act and save a little. So they devise a plan to escape the siege. The problem is that the Bir Yonai have placed guards on the entrance of the city so no one can leave. They don't want people just fleeing Jerusalem. So again, you see the irony here that while Bar Kamsa pleaded with his host to stay in a place of plenty in this party, but was forced to leave, the rabbis desire to abandon this place of starvation, but are forced to stay. Perhaps as this midah keneged midah, punishments. So Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai devises a plan for him to leave the city. So let's continue. He says, what's their plan? He said to them, pretend to be ill. Let everyone come to inquire about you, right? Pretend that you're sick. Everyone's going to come to see how you're doing. Bring something evil smelling and put it by you so they will say that you're dead. Then let your disciples get under your bed, but no others, so they'll not notice that you're still light, since they know a living being is lighter than a corpse. He's going to pretend to die and then sneak out of the city as in a coffin. He did so. And Rabbi Eliezer went under the bier from one side, Rabbi Yehoshua from the other. When they reached the door, when they came to the exits of Jerusalem, some men wanted to put a lance through the bier. They wanted to stab the coffin to make sure he's really dead. He said to them, "Should the Romans say they have pierced their masters?" Right, the same questioning that we saw earlier with the korban. What are people going to say about this? They wanted to give it a push, right, to push it over to see what's inside. He said to them, "Shall they say they pushed their master?" Right? What are people going to say about this? So they opened a town gate for him, and he got out. So again, part of this hesitancy, right, is what will people think? And I think part of the role of a good leader is making difficult decisions, even when other people who are maybe perhaps less informed might think otherwise. But Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai's plan is successful, and he's able to escape the city. So he meets up with the emperor Vespasian and asks him for a few requests in the paragraph G. He says to him, "I'm now going and will send someone to take my place. You can, however," that's what Vespasian says, "you can make a request of me and I will grant it." He said to him, give me Yavna and its wise men. Give me at least something. I can't save Jerusalem, I can't save Yerushalayim, but at least I can save Torah to some degree in the city of Yavna. But the Gemara comments that he should have actually asked for more, right? Rav Yosef or some sort of Akiva said to apply this verse to him, "God turns wise men backward and makes their knowledge foolish." He ought to have said, "Let the Jews off this time," right? He was talking to the emperor. He should have just asked for peace with the Jews. Perhaps they're saying, Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai here is being too meek. He's being too cautious, too wimpy to ask for what he really wanted. But then the Gemara defends him. He, however, right in the Gemara, thought that so much he would not grant, and so even a little would not be saved. Right, the emperor would have said, "Oh, you're asking for too much, forget this whole thing. I'm not going to give you anything." Right, if he would have asked for more, he might not have gotten anything. So which was correct? Should he have asked for more or not? And perhaps it's purposely ambiguous. It's not always so clear for us how to draw the line between being cautious and being overly cautious, but we do our best. So to summarize what we've spoken about so far, we've read several narratives that describe the events leading up to the destruction of Yerushalayim. These stories open up with a statement saying that being cautious is wise, but being overly cautious can bring calamity. And we have seen that play out in these stories. The trait of being too cautious to the point of debilitation, in which someone, specifically a leader, cannot make decisions and therefore cannot act, contributed to the destruction of Yerushalayim in the Beit HaMikdash. The little bit of hope that we were able to achieve to allow Torah study to continue in Yavna came about because Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai finally made the decision to take action. I think that these narratives, read in this light, have several messages for us today as we mark Tisha B'Av. With regards to leadership, these stories emphasize the importance of the need for good leaders who will stand up and model what's right. Leaders are often faced with difficult decisions. And we know that. And on the one hand, it's important for leaders to be humble, not to be arrogant, not to think that they know what's right in every situation, can never be wrong, and to not display caution in thinking out what ramifications might come out from their decisions. On the other hand, once someone is in a leadership position, they can't be passive and now bring in their humility and say, I don't know what to do, and give up when the difficult situation arises. Leaders have to take control and do their best to help their people through difficult situations, while at the same time recognizing that there might not be one right answer and they might make a mistake. In the words of Rabbi Yochanan, leaders must be cautious but not meek. And we as people need to give our leaders our trust and our confidence to help them make tough decisions. You know, why is it that the rabbis did not act at the party? So, you know, maybe they didn't think the people would support them. But the Maharsha says because the host was such a powerful person. The rabbis didn't want to, you know, they didn't want to insult or be on bad terms with his host. So we as people need to give our leaders the ability to make these decisions even when they're not easy. And on a personal level, I think these stories emphasize that we need to lead our lives as active decision makers. We should not be pushed through life, you know, carried with the wind based on other people's decisions or based on what other people might think, right? How other people might interpret our actions. Rather, we have to think about how we want to live our lives as Jews and actively choose to live our lives that will bring about the goals that we set for ourselves. May we be inspired by these stories to seek out good, upstanding leaders who are role models for us and under their guidance become more proactive in our lives as Jews. In so doing, we merit to see the reversal of destruction in Harabiyamenu.